And yeah, I'm rolling over here on my recorder, so you won't be able to hear your side, but you'll just hear my voice on my recording.
Great. Okay. So yeah, you're listening to Teatro Mundi Live. I'm Andrea Citrullo, program curator at Teatro Mundi, and today I'm joined by Tyler Sonicson, cultural geographer who studies music, media, tourism, and oral histories. He is the author of Capitals of Punk, Paris, DC, and Circulation in the Urban Underground, published in 2019 by Palgrave. Tyler and I met at Teatro Mundi Sonic Urbanism Colloquium in Paris in December, where he presented his research on punk, oral history, and the voice of the Rebinches city. It then occurred to me that it would be a wonderful thing for him to share some of his favorites, homemade, home-recorded, home-produced records, or shall we say garage, and talk a little bit about their modes of production and circulation. At Teatro Mundi, we've been exploring the theme of the home as a space for making and for intimacy, as well as a place where the outside world is brought into, blurring the lines between the public and the private. What nowadays is done from a laptop and disseminated online, before it was recorded in a tape or distributed among networks worldwide through post or brought from a record shop to the bedroom to enjoy. So welcome, Tyler. Thanks so much for joining me. So have these lockdown times been good for revisiting, reordering your record collection?
Well, hi, Andrea. It's really great to speak to you again. Thank you for having me. It's been the last couple of weeks have, you know, it's absolutely been a time of a lot of self-reflection. One of the things that I've done, you know, as much as there's a debate raging online, especially among academics, it seems, over whether we should pressure ourselves to be more productive in this time, or also just sort of understand that our feelings are valid, you know, either depression that many of us might be experiencing because our lives have been, you know, the plans that we had for the spring have been sidelined eventually into the summer. Mm-hmm. And understanding that these are ahistorical circumstances. And, you know, there are so many things in my mind that I was going through that I would like to get done while however often we're self-quarantining, or depending on where you are in the world, enforced quarantine. But one of the things that I've been doing was, you know, using Instagram Live to stream some DJ sets, just to get, you know, just as an opportunity, to DJ. I had a DJ gig booked, what was supposed to be on the 25th of March. And I had worked for a long time to get that gig. And then I think we booked it about a week or so before everything started to shut down. So I just decided, all right, you know what? I'm just going to do it on Instagram. Anyone who wants to tune in, you know, watch for a bit, that's awesome. And realistically, the number of people who saw that stream was probably, you know, in total number of people who watched it live or people who watched the replay mm-hmm. on Instagram, it was probably roughly the number of people who would have been in the bar that night.
Wow, that's not bad.
It's a small bar, and it's a Wednesday night, and I live in a pretty small town. So, it's you know, it's interesting seeing, you know, figuring out other ways to create and to present that material, and just kind of, you know, not go crazy at this point.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we are trying to do something very similar from TM. So this is our second podcast, actually, with you. And I thought it would be a really great idea to kind of talk a little bit about your work in relation to, you know, the situation, but also further back in chronology. So you can actually speak a little bit about your, you know, punk history, oral culture, and especially about modes of circulation. This is one of the things that you just mentioned, you know, how we can disseminate or how we can connect to each other. But then it also begs the question of, you know, how do these situations inform the work itself, which is something that can be reflected through music and the way that it sounds and the directness of it, or the production itself, or how it's consumed. So all of these things I would like you to, you know, kind of elaborate on.
Sure. One of the lasting lessons, and this was before I consciously got involved in in the DIY punk scene as just a fan and I guess earlier on kind of a part-time reporter in ways, but mostly just someone who enjoyed the music and enjoyed the, you know, how the valuable life lessons that you would learn at shows and you would learn at gigs.
Mm-hmm.
When last year at the AAG meeting, the American Association of Geographers meeting, it was actually held in Washington, D.C. Of course, our meeting this year in Denver was canceled, but last year, the meeting in D.C. was, I can't remember what the official total of people who attended, but we did a Q&A, or I hosted a Q&A with Ian Mackay from you know, best known probably from Fugazi as the lead singer of Minor Threat, as the co-founder of Discord Records, and also one of the instrumental, or at least one of the people very instrumental in the early kind of genesis of emotional hardcore or emo. And it drew a really big crowd, and he didn't know going into it because I told him it was an academic conference, and he was wondering, like, the night before we were talking on the phone, he said, "Do you think people are going to be there?" I was like, "Oh yeah, I guarantee you people will be there." Because everyone in that room, before they became a geographer, either as an academic, as a GI scientist, as a cartographer, they were music fans.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot, you know, as he was telling stories from, you know, especially he was telling stories from, you know, the Minor Threat days and the, you know, Revolution Summer in 85 through the Fugazi days and touring in France that we talked a little bit about. There were a lot of like lasting lessons about the importance of community. And one of the things that I really took from, you know, just from my years of living in DC when I was in my 20s, and then my years of living in Knoxville and producing comedy shows when I was in Knoxville, and also just, you know, going to a lot of gigs when I was living there, was that it is so much more rewarding to have a very devoted audience of 20 than it is to have a very ambivalent audience of 200.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very rare. Like, you know, there's a very, very narrow sliver of artists. You might even say like an almost infinitesimal percentage of artists that have, you know, someone like Harry Styles or Taylor Swift who has, you know, a Coliseum full of very devoted fans, like ATS or something like that. Like that's almost, if you looked at the pie chart, that would barely even register. Like the line of people who actually have a mix of the two would barely even register. And a lot of people are, you know, and I think especially before this, and, you know, a lot of artists, of course, have been very adversely impacted. A lot of, you know, countless gigs have been canceled over the next couple of months. Festivals have been canceled. But I think, you know, but coming from punk and DIY, you tend to have this perspective, especially when you look at a festival that's big and bloated like Coachella, you wonder, why do we necessarily need this? Why have we gotten to a point where it's like the only sustainable model?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The short answer is Ticketmaster, because they're the devil, but also because, you know, Ticketmaster, the blurb there is that Ticketmaster inspired Pearl Jam to do their own concert in California, which eventually became Coachella. And now Pearl Jam actually just put out a new record, and so much of vinyl Instagram was going crazy about it. So, but you know, even a band that was as huge as they were and still are as huge as they are, like Pearl Jam, still is able to sort of remind us of a lot of those lessons that we can learn at a time like this, which is understand that you need to play for yourself first. You need to create something that is honest. Going back to one thing that Ian Mackay talked about and has been talking about for 30, 40 years in interviews now, is that, you know, if you put something out there that's not honest, then if you have an audience, they're going to pick up on it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So you have to everything that you have to put out into the ether, especially because most of everything that we're putting out right now, especially when we're recording this, is on the internet in some form.
Yes.
You have to remember that honesty is at the center of it. And it's much more rewarding to, you know, maybe have like put something out there that is going to impact 10 or 15 people. And then each of those 10 or 15 people is going to pass that on to like 10 friends. And then each of those people is going to pass that on. That's how things go viral. And, you know, sometimes things go viral that are not necessarily substantive, just like a meme that is forgotten it within 2 weeks. But what, especially in DC and in, you know, in Paris in the 80s with their respective hardcore scenes, was it was a lot of bands playing for something that meant a lot to them, and they didn't have aspirations for it to reach, you know, millions and millions of people around the world. Ultimately, in some cases, like Minor Threat, for example, that absolutely did. Minor Threat changed the world. But if you told them that in 1982, they were too busy complaining about scene politics in 1982 and trying to break up at that point. Then of course they got back together and they got in, and you know, it's very easy to get caught up in your little bubble. So maybe that's a silver lining, or one of the countless silver linings we've been trying to kind of put together in our heads over the last couple of weeks. And depending on when people are listening to this, people will probably still be looking at silver linings or looking back at the time of coronavirus, silver linings. And I think it's, you know, like understanding how to better curate your audience, understanding that there's going to be, you know, just making something just for the sake of making it and putting it out there can be very productive, but you have to understand that you're not going to keep hitting home runs. You have to understand that that once something's out there, it's out there. And, you know, there are going to be, that's also the nature of memes. But again, sometimes people forget them, but other times they stick around. You just can't get them to go away. So,
yeah.
There's a whole bunch of new kind of spatial dynamics at play, or virtual spatial dynamics at play.
Yes, this is very interesting. And I think one of the things that I really like about your work, and I would like to ask you about it, is the use of archives.
Yeah.
So more specifically, I'd like to know how you, or the process through which you unearth these gems of archival material, oral history, perhaps, you know, things that existed in a certain time, in a small circuit, as you were saying, and were just left in a, I don't know, in a garage, or somehow disappeared also because of the modes of circulation, and if probably a cassette or a CD even up to a certain point. So yeah, it would be interesting hearing about the use of archival material in your work.
What's one thing that's funny, you mentioned cassettes and CDs. You know, I'm a big analog nerd, like many of us are, but also we're speaking to each other over the internet right now, using digital means. But I realized that, you know, compact discs are actually, depending on where you live and depending on what your means are, compact discs can be very difficult to play, because many cars are not made with CD players anymore. And a lot of CDs, there are a lot of bands that would put CDs out there, and they're basically creating plastic. That's what it was for much of the 90s and 2000s. And even still today, you know, when I see someone who makes, you know, when I go to a merch table and I see, you know, just like boxes and boxes of CDs, wondering, you know, like, I think a lot of the people who want the physical are going to just want vinyl. They're going to want a cassette necessarily. Because
I have to say that I quite like CDs. Vinyls are too big. So I started collecting them, and there's this thing where you move around and there's just like, you know, at some point you love them, but you have to make a decision, and you're kind of a burden in a way. I like the format of the CD.
I think as a format, there's great things and there's bad things, because they do eventually lose data after a while, and a lot of people also, you know, you and I both remember a time when everyone just got rid of the artwork and the case and just put them in folders, which was not good for the CDs. People would stack the CDs like two or three deep in each pocket, and they would just scratch them all.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the thing about, you know, vinyl is not for everybody. It's definitely very hard to move. You know, whenever you move and you have a record collection, it's increasingly, because, you know, you stay one place for a few years, you accumulate more records. You stay another place for a couple of years, you accumulate more after each move. One thing that I've actually started to do is downsize my collection. So I think as collectors of whatever, you know, it can be vinyl records, it can be books. Mm-hmm. As someone becomes more mobile, then they realize, like, oh, well, this book or this record might serves somebody else better. Like there may be somebody who would love to have this and willing to pay me money for this. And I'm just like, well, why would I deny them? You know?
I suppose at that time, the time that you're looking at, it was mostly cassettes. And that's actually the cover, I believe, of your book. There's a cassette.
Yeah.
So I don't know how much choice you had in that, but
From Palgrave was, I can't remember if it was her or Josh Pitt. It was someone in the editorial department engineered that cover, and I still can't get over how much I like it.
The cassette as a mode of easy access and production and recording where you can just like edit, you know. And also of circulation, you know, if you send it by post at that time, it was something very, very simple to actually do. How do you actually, going a bit back to my question, how do you actually go about finding these things and then, you know, kind of investigating them as archival material?
Well, the one thing that I still believe, you know, it's we're rapidly putting, and that's another, you know, silver lining of coronavirus. There's a lot that is going on the internet as we speak, or as anyone is listening to this, like as I'm saying this, there is data that is being converted to analog, from analog to digital, that's going on the internet. But I would still argue that a majority of the world's data still doesn't exist on the internet. I mean, we have what feels like a countless bottomless pit of data that exists on the internet, you know, books that are digitized and in e-reader form, music that is digitized, but there are still, you know, there are still recordings from the 1920s and 30s that are apocryphal, meaning we don't know, we have no proof that they were ever made. My great-grandfather actually there were a number of news clippings of his bands from the 1920s and 1940s that I still have that refer to his orchestra as the recording orchestra. Whether or not that was used as just a method for advertising the band, because back in the 20s, especially if you were recording, that meant that you were really cool, that you were very like big and successful. So it's possible that he made recordings, but to my knowledge, none of them have survived. But I still am holding on hope that one day I'm going to track one down. Because there are, you know, there are attics, warehouses, basements, storehouses. There's Amanda Petrusich, who's one of my favorite music journalists, wrote a very entertaining and very informative book called Do Not Sell at Any Price. I think that's the title. It's just her experience interviewing and getting to know some of the world's most obsessive blues and jazz 78 collectors. People from like recordings from the 20s and 30s. Like I think there are four extant copies of Skip James' Devil Got My Woman, for example. But even a recording like that, because it was digitized, because it was remastered, and it's very easily accessible on YouTube, people kind of take that for granted. But there are still songs out there. There are oral traditions and analog, even stuff that was recorded on analog formats that's going extinct right now because
The particular track I remember from a scene, you've probably seen it, Ghost World, where there's a record collector. I do remember that track. So it was presented in that kind of precious way.
Precious way is a very good way to describe it. Like, I've got no enmity towards Daniel Clowes or Steve Buscemi or Thora Birch, but I think the way that record collectors are depicted is usually very unsavory. I have to admit this on the podcast, I haven't read High Fidelity by Nick Hornby, but I hate the movie adaptation. And everyone assumes that I love it because I like records, but they're like, oh, you must love the movie High Fidelity. I'm like, no, I absolutely hate it. Like, I just do not like it. Like, it basically is what people who never go to record shops think record shops are like. And it's the same thing with Ghost World, where it's, I mean, understandably, Daniel Clowes is from that. He's kind of from that world, and he knows what some of these collectors are like. So Steve Buscemi is a great actor, and he does a pretty good job of sort of depicting that very stereotypical 78 collector. He's like, well, actually, it's from a different style of music that was pioneered a bit. And, you know, and that's, I think that that's just the stereotype that people like to rag on record collectors for all being like, but you know, you don't see, that's the cool thing about the Instagram vinyl community, because that's where you see particularly women in vinyl, like women, the fact that women collect
vinyl. Wouldn't probably visit a certain type, I'm not sure, or different sections as well of a record shop. I mean, been confronted with that myself.
Most,
just walking in and, you know.
Yeah.
Feeling slightly out of place, especially when I was younger. I was like, that kind of silence, you know, the oppressing silence and the scrolling, you know, you're like, oh, my hands are not even big enough. I can't scroll through all these records. The way that everything is set up. But yeah, I think it would be really great if we could talk a little bit about your selection, which seems to be a mix. So I'm interested in what connects these four records that you chose, and then what makes them distinct, and that you speak a little bit about them. Yes.
Oh man, you don't have to twist my arm. This conversation we're about to have is basically the type of conversation I would be having with one of my music nerd friends anyway. So
well, I'm happy to hear that.
The ability to have this conversation on a podcast, especially for an organization like Teatro Mundi, is, you know, the listeners can't see what I just did, but I just did the OK symbol with my hand.
You did the OK symbol.
Just like the blah, you know.
Fantastic. I think they have an order, a particular order, but you can also talk us through it.
Sure.
So we got Bomb, the music industry. Yes. Yeah.
Well, Bomb the Music Industry was probably the longest standing project by Jeff Rosenstock. So I'll talk, rather than talk specifically about Bomb the Music Industry, I'll talk about the career arc of Jeff Rosenstock, who has become kind of the new, at least in the 21st century, any list, you know, like music websites are really big into lists, you know, like people, it's clickbait, you know, it's like the 10 most important or influential musicians working today or whatever. 10 greatest guitarists of all time. And it's all a bunch of like baby boomer like garbage. But, you know, they have like those sites, those lists will never put someone like D Boone or, you know, someone active today, like David Vassalotti or, you know, somebody who's like Andy Gill, who just passed away. Like the actual best guitarists of all time are never put on those lists. But anyway, any list that I see that doesn't include Jeff Rosenstock in some format for, in terms of most influential musician today on some level, is kidding itself. He, just a quick overview on who he was. He's from Long Island. He's just like a, you know, about my age. I want to say he's in his late 30s. So he came of age in the late 90s in the Long Island punk scene. And he had a band in high school that operated in fits and starts, just like most high school bands do. I mean, a lot of great punk bands did. I talked about Minor Threat, and they were mostly a high school band, and then they sort of broke up when a couple of members went to college. But in the late 90s, I can't remember exactly when Arrogant Sons of Bitches started, but he had a band he was the lead singer and guitarist for called the Arrogant Sons of Bitches. And they put out a couple of, you know, CDRs that they made. They were on a ton of compilations. And the first time I actually heard them was when I was in college. This is in 2004, 2005, during the file sharing era, when a compilation, I don't think it was actually a formal release, it was just a compilation of a bunch of songs that Arrogant Sons of Bitches had recorded. And they were very, it was something that, it was similar to what I'd been listening to in the late 90s, early 2000s with Third Wave Ska, but it had that like much more playful, much more sort of like jumping into the pit, and also being very, like, his lyrics were either incredibly ironic or very detached, or a lot of just, we didn't talk about language usage on the podcast, but I already said the name of the band, Arrogant Sons of Bitches, but just basically trash talking, you know, scene politics. And a lot of it seemed very reactionary to what was just making him angry. And it was kind of like that whole personal equals political. Mm-hmm. And I remember it definitely left an impression on me. And then a few years later, this is probably late 2000s or 2010, I started to hear about this newer band that he was touring with called Bomb the Music Industry. And The last time I actually saw them before he discontinued the project was, I think, in 2011, when they came to DC to perform with the Max Levine Ensemble for that band's 10th anniversary show. They opened for them. And that's when I started to retrace the history of what Bond the music industry was. Apparently, and this is where the bedroom, this is where the mythology of Bond the music industry comes into play. After Arrogant Sons of Bitches broke up, and it was a notoriously, I mean, this was before Facebook. Well, Facebook was in its infancy at the time. Twitter wasn't really around yet.
Kind of MySpace time.
Yeah, during the MySpace time. So there was, you know, there was a lot of trash talking on the internet, but a lot of it was just kind of almost rumors that would get blown out of proportion, because maybe you might know somebody who went to high school with Jeff Rosenstock and they heard like, oh yeah, the band got into a fist fight on stage and then they broke up. Little things like that, you know, we didn't know what the case was with how his band broke up, but everyone just knew that the band ended in this kind of cloud of acrimony in the mid 2000s. They eventually did get back together. They eventually did do a reunion gig, which was of course sold out almost instantly. And I think they did it back in Long Island. But what Bond the music industry was him in his bedroom,
okay,
no longer having a band. Like when he started it at first, like he put out a record called Album Minus Band, it was very prominently displayed on the cover. And you could tell in his lyrics how he was sick of playing gigs. He was sick of, you know, especially as an unknown. And for the first half of Bond the music industry, he still kind of was. Nowadays, he's a name. Nowadays, he's known. Like he's toured with bands like Joyce Manor. He can sell out like mid-sized clubs on his own name, but that's what he was doing for pretty much the entire 21st century. Around the time ASOB started to grow a little bit in popularity, that's when they fell apart. So he kind of, he also had a lot of problems with substance abuse issues. You know, he was drinking a lot. And the way he describes it on his website, on quote unquote records.com, which is, I think it's a site he still maintains, or other like musicians he worked with still maintains. He describes it as a bout of sobriety. He had this burst of creativity and this ability to just record using a drum machine on his computer and a guitar that was hardwired into his computer and very like cheap, crappy keyboards and stuff like that. And he also admitted there's a weird sound on that first Bond the music industry record. There's a weird sound that you hear of like a can popping, like a can of soda like opening up. That sound is because he was using the free version of the software, of the audio editing software, and he just left it on the recording. Like there were when just, you know, how they put like, it, especially if you're using a free video editor, the internet, they have like a watermark that they put on the screen, so you can't use that footage really, unless you don't mind having a big old watermark that has nothing
to do with it. So it goes beyond, in this case, it goes beyond the sound. You also have the artwork. It's all DIY. Yes. All of it. It extends, it's a culture. It extends beyond its sonic properties, I suppose. Oh, but also the sonic properties, that's something I would like to kind of talk about. And, you know, how that intimacy and the isolation itself reflects on the work, and that freedom that might come from being in your own room and doing whatever you want and not caring too much about going to listen to it. And, you know, that kind of like, directness in a way, through the mediums that are used, but also the meaning.
Yeah, absolutely. Rosenstock's, you know, he's talked about this a lot, how he kind of felt that, you know, when you're, when you start a band as a teenager, you know, and I can't claim to have had this experience myself for better or for worse, but when you start a band as a teenager and then you have that band for, until the time you're probably like into your early 20s, that is, you know, a third of your life.
Mm-hmm.
So you have trouble thinking about, you know, when you're 22, the idea of being 30 seems unimaginably far away.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that absolutely kind of informed the fact that, you know, this thing that had been part of his life for such a huge part of his life was no longer there, but he also was, a lot of the lyrics kind of come off as sour grapes about it too, because there's a song on Album Minus Band called Free Bird. And that's literally the title. It's like all caps. It's like spelled out like that.
Yeah.
Where he just talks about, I think it was Laura Stevenson, who's known for her band Laura Stevenson and the Cans.
But also, you speak, sorry to cross, but you were just speaking about how he achieved this alone in his room with, you know, a program. At that time, it was more accessible already. But then, in a way, that solitude and that intimacy means that you wouldn't need the infrastructure that it requires to, like, if you have a band, for example, or needing other people around you. Yeah. Which is kind of the essential difference, right, between, I suppose, bedroom-produced music and a band, where there's a stage. Yeah,
that actually reminds me a bit of what Dan Deacon was doing early on in his career. It was actually I didn't send you any Dan Deacon tracks, but he's actually the fifth person. I think you asked me for five, and I delivered four. Because, you know, I'm a rebel like that, but also because I couldn't think of a fifth. But now that you mentioned that, I thought about Dan Deacon, who is
an electronic artist
from Baltimore, and he played in bands for a long time when he was at SUNY Purchase, and then he and a bunch of other of his co-creators and co-conspirators moved to Baltimore after they finished college there. But he was like a composition major, so he actually had a musical background. As far as Jeff Rosenstock, very talented musician. I'm not sure about his musical background so much as just, you know, playing in bands and like learning how to play music, just as you do with learning the piano at a young age. Mm-hmm. But Dan Deacon always talked about how when his early on, like in 2006 or seven, when he first started to become known as a solo artist, his setup was just something that he could transport in a suitcase. It was just a board with a bunch of pedals, and he would play music off of a little iPod shuffle that mm-hmm. was taped to a banana. And it would run through all of his pedals, and he would like run his vocals through the pedals, and he would always perform on the floor. Like everyone, the crowd would basically be crowding around him. So I think that era, you know, that time when I was graduating college, like the mid 2000s, where this new software emerged, like the software that Rosenstock used to record Album Minus Band. And then even, and he kept working with, and he specifies which I think he on his website on Quote Unquote Records, he talks about the instruments that are used in the production of each of the albums. He put out an album in 07 called Goodbye Cool World, which has a track on there called King of Minneapolis Parts 3 and 4, which might be the most, and I think it was all just him still at that point, but it's one of the most like thrashing, like intense, just kind of like makes you want to just like fly over your house.
That's the energy that is captured through some of the bands. Well, I don't know all of them, but for example, if you could talk about the Twilight Singers right now, which I know Mark Lanegan, roughly some of his work. I do know the Afghan Twigs guy, who's called again, Afghan Wigs.
That's his name.
Yeah. Yes. And they have this project called the Gutter Twins that I was mentioning to you before. But there are two, aren't they? The Twilight Singers. There are two people. Or how many are they?
Twilight Singers was actually, and this is where it gets very, very nerdy, but I'll try to keep this part condensed. The Afghan Wigs was a band that was formed. It was Greg Dooley as the singer and songwriter, chief singer, songwriter, John Curley on bass. And I'm trying to remember the name of their original. Like they had a couple of earlier guitarists, a drummer named Steve Earle, who was actually like not the country singer, but he happened to be named Steve Earle. I think that was the Afghan Wigs. But anyway, they started in Cincinnati in the late 80s. They were sort of like a post-hardcore, you know, they kind of got roped into, they were actually the first, it was either them or the Dwarves from Chicago who were the first non-Seattle band signed to Sub Pop. And then they put out a record called Up In It in 1990 or 91, mm-hmm. which even though it was very grunge, kind of aesthetically very grunge, they weren't from Seattle, so they were detached from that scene, but they were also paying a very clear homage to Black music. And you know, a lot of the, you know, the grunge bands were all like huge fans of like old, like R&B and blues, but it might not have come through as clearly in their music and lyrics, at least in terms of the stuff that got really popular in the early 90s from bands like, you know, Pearl Jam and Soundgarden.
And The Screaming Trees was in Mark Lanegan and The Screaming Trees. Yeah, I think so.
Bingo. So Afghan Whigs was like existed through the 90s. They broke up in 98 or 99. But around that time, Dooley's kind of formed a new band that had been kind of like a side project here and there that he called the Twilight Singers. And it was effectively just him. I mean, he didn't do all the music. Like he had an ensemble of musicians around him. I think Jeff Klein was playing violin for him. And still to this day, one of the most like heart-wrenching violin performances I've ever seen. I saw it at the Auto Bar. Greg Dooley just did a solo gig there probably like 2010 or 2011. And it nearly brought me to tears. But
so he is the singers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dooley is the singer in pretty much all of the projects he does. And the Gutter Twins is the only one where he had a co-vocalist. Mm-hmm. He actually just put his first technical, like full debut solo album out. Okay. It's actually really good. But, you know, he's in his 50s now. And, you know, if you saw him in the early 90s, you saw him in like the late 80s, early 90s era of the Afghan Whigs, you'd be like, that guy's not going to make it to 40.
I remember some of their videos.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, a lot of.
But this album, Powder Burns, that you chose, you were saying this post Katrina, what you wrote to me, using power generators. So why did you choose that one?
The Legend of Powder Burns is that, first of all, it's important to understand that Dooley had kind of adopted New Orleans as his new hometown sometime in the 90s. Because even though the Afghan Whigs were from Cincinnati, their name was a play on Black Republicans, which I can't remember who wrote the 33 and a third book about their album Gentlemen, but they had a couple of major label albums. They did okay, but they didn't, you know, they didn't get to Nirvana numbers or Smashing Pumpkins numbers things like that. So they kind of dissolved, but by 98, when they put out, the Afghan Whigs put out what is my favorite album of theirs. It's called 1965. And it's got a very clear, you know, it's got a very clear, like Nina Simone, Temptations influence on it. It's very R&B influenced. And he was living in New Orleans at that time. I think he was living there full time. So when the Twilight Singers emerged, they put out the first album he put out as the Twilight Singers was, I want to say in 2000, it was just called Twilight is Played by the Twilight Singers. Mm-hmm. And then it made a bit of a splash, but I don't remember it being a particular kind of like, you know, a lightning bolt or anything like that. And then in 2003, he was working on a solo album and his best friend, the director, I think it was Ted Demme who died. He died very young and he shelved that project and he decided to put some of those songs into a new project called Powder Burns, which was dedicated to his late friend. Not Powder Burns, I apologize. Blackberry Bell. Blackberry Bell is my favorite thing Greg Dooley has ever done. It is a heartbreaking masterpiece. It is a work of staggering genius. And that's one of my Desert Island discs, their 2003 album, Blackberry Bell. But specifically for what you asked me about, I thought about Powder Burns because it's not so much the solo or created in isolation, but it was created almost in defiance of poor governorship, poor leadership, and the culture that was existing, or at least the messages that were circulating, again in the mid 2000s, just like that unique cultural moment where we're sort of entering the era of social media when Jeff Rosenstock started Bomb the Music Industry. Mm-hmm. Around that time, because Blackberry Bell did very well with college radio, and it was pretty well received for an indie album at the time. But then in 2005, August of 2005 was when Katrina hit. Then the flooding happened. And then New Orleans became this flashpoint of, first of all, you know, white America being shocked, absolutely shocked that any Americans still lived like this, like completely, completely ignoring the reality that so many Americans face. And coronavirus is opening up those wounds all over again. But also the way that people spoke about New Orleans during and after the Katrina disaster was it became increasingly evident what their politics were. And I think that you could trace a lot of these ideas that the rhetoric you're hearing from the right in the United States right now about how the economy is more important than human lives. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that rhetoric kind of around like, you know, look, well, what's so bad about all the poor people who died? You know, like they were all on welfare, blah, blah, blah. It was just a very, you know, incredibly racist, derisive, classist, like bits of rhetoric that were circulating around New Orleans, especially because that was a huge difference between the flooding of Katrina in 2005 versus the flooding that happened in Houston in 2018, I believe it was. Social media, and there were apps that people had on their phones that helped them get to certain sites for safety and high ground points that were open to the public. And in Katrina, people had cell phones. Facebook and social media were still on their way to where they were by 2008 or so. But there is a lot of it was because of defiance. Again, I talked about that in terms of the conditions that Rosenstock recorded Album Minus Band under and those first couple bombing the music industry records. It was the same type of defiance that influenced Greg Dooley just to like put both of his middle fingers up and say, hey, you know, we're not leaving. This is our city. This is New Orleans. And we have a space that we can still use. Our instruments are here. We're going to record as much of this album as we can in New Orleans. And most of it was recorded while the city was still bleeding very heavily from.
And it was created through the use of power generators.
Yeah.
How did that work?
Oh, just because the power grid in New Orleans was so, I mean, it was still, yeah, in 2007, the first time I went back to New Orleans after Katrina was 2007 in December. And I think a couple of the streetcar lines had just partially opened back up. And that's about a year and a half after the flooding and the disaster, and much of the disaster, at least that occurred in the direct wake of the hurricane. So my friend who I stayed with, you know, the power would just go off intermittently over the course of the day. A lot of contractors that were kind of swooping in like vultures, and many of them weren't certified, but because the city was so, you know, the city was so stricken of people who were able to fix the large scale destruction that occurred to the power grid. So, I mean, most of the people and a lot of creatives who had the ability to leave New Orleans, many went to Memphis, many went to Houston, many went to Los Angeles. Of course, Dooley eventually did. I think he owned a bar in Los Angeles I don't know if he owned it at the time, but mm-hmm. But he made a very conscious decision. Like he and his bandmates could have gone someplace else to finish the record, but they decided not to.
So was that created from a studio, from the home? Do you know how that was?
I'm not sure. I think it was a makeshift studio that they had built prior to the flood. And then when the flood happened, I think that, you know, I have to go back and look at the liner notes mm-hmm. to see like what studios it was recorded. It might be a studio that Dooley owns, or it's maybe one on his property.
Mm.
I'm not positive about that.
Now maybe we can speak about the streets. I'm looking at, I lost the list for a moment. We got streets where you're in your email, you were telling me apparently Mike Skinner recorded most of original pirate material in his bedroom.
That's what I read. Like that was how he was advertised to American college radio at the time. Prior to the streets. And you know, this is, you know, the history of hip hop is dominated by it's like the most successful or biggest selling hip hop artists, such as the Beastie Boys, Eminem. I don't know. I mean, I know the streets are still very big over in Europe, and he still does well whenever he comes over here. But and we'd had British, like, you know, it wasn't completely unfamiliar to hear a British accent rapping. But mm-hmm. there hadn't really been, you know, like Slick Rick had been prominent on the charts for a very long time, going back to the 80s. But that was the first time, like, I can remember learning about this new thing called grime, at least new to us. This was in 2002 or 2003. And I remember hearing it, like, you know, hearing songs like Turn the Page and what else was on original pirate material. Mm-hmm. And I was working at this college station at Syracuse University at the time. And I remember hearing it play. And I was just kind of like, oh, this is almost abrasive, just because we weren't used to hearing. Keep in mind, the turn of the millennium, to the turn of the century, there were so few, I would argue very few British artists that were doing anything in terms of the charts in the United States.
This that you were saying, you said, I heard it as something abrasive, or maybe the modulation as well in the voice. And, you know, there's a difference there where perhaps American more produced, studio recorded, mastered, you know, hip hop is slightly more sleek. So that aspect of it would be good to explore, because it's the texture, that kind of like materiality that you can listen to.
Oh, totally.
That makes a difference. So if it was recorded in a room, I assume it was pretty basic in that sense.
Yeah, there's my favorite song on that album, and one of my favorite songs of this entire century, is Don't Mug Yourself. And that was recorded with Calvin Bailey, was another person who raps on that track. So it wasn't completely done in isolation. It wasn't completely done in his bedroom. But the way that it was marketed, especially to the United States, because I think the way that they looked at the streets was, you know, this is something that's not going to, it's not going to, you know, Mike Skinner is not going to be up there in the United States with Eminem, or at the time Nelly or DMX or artists like that who were selling out stadiums. Mm-hmm. So the way that the streets were marketed was, this is a guy, this is a real, like, authentic sort of, you know, Adidas tracksuit wearing white guy with grills from England. Mm-hmm. Who recorded most of these like vocal tracks and mixed and produced them in his bedroom while his girlfriend was asleep on the bed behind him, you know, just really sort of selling that authenticity to us. And of course, this was the precursor for, at least for a lot of Americans, this was the precursor to Dizzy Rascal, mm-hmm. and Wiley, and the wave of grime artists, none of which particularly, I mean, now Stormzy is getting a lot of traction over here, but you know, prior to original pirate material, and again, you know, I've always been kind of late to the party when it comes to hip hop trends, but I remember that it was sort of I don't know how it was necessarily marketed in the UK. I'm sure that the marketing was fairly similar, but you know, at the time we were just learning what grime was, and we were learning that, you know, grime, you know, authenticity has always been a really big selling point in hip hop, even, you know, some of the artists that were the most oversaturated, like MC Hammer, for example, and Vanilla Ice in the early 90s, during the era of the pre-internet monoculture, people just started to turn on them because, first of all, what they were doing was very dishonest. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, coming into the early part of the 20th century, the way that original pirate material was, you know, first marketed, and then critics loved it. Like, American critics just couldn't get enough of the streets. And then of course he did the proper thing, which was put out a great second record. So he didn't wear out that welcome that he got with original pirate material. He put out A Grand Don't Come for Free a couple of years later. And I just remember being blown away by that. But also around that time, Dizzy Rascal put out Boy in the Corner. And there was this sort of like unapologetic, like almost overemphasis on authenticity that came along with that. And I think the sound, certainly, like the way that original pirate material sounds, it could have very easily been done in a bedroom. I don't know how much of it actually was versus how much of it was time, but
an impression. No, it seems like all of these tracks that you have chosen share that. They have that aspect in common. The, well, honesty, playfulness, kind of childlike qualities, almost sort of very intimate at the same time. They have different styles, but they definitely share that.
Yeah, and the title track to Powder Burns is this kind of like booming triumphant song that almost sounds like going back to the Twilight Singers, it's almost the sound of New Orleans just sort of rising like a phoenix from the ashes. But that's probably exactly what they were going for.
And you also added, this is the fourth and last, just because we're running out of time, that is the mountain goats. And what you wrote to me is that the mythology of John Darnielle recording much of All Hail West Texas on a boombox while on breaks as a hospital orderly.
Yeah, he actually put out a great reissue of this album. They did a gatefold vinyl reissue with where he writes a bunch of essays. John Darnielle has become, and this is why I put him toward the bottom of my list, because I just assumed that somebody else would want to talk about him. I've been a fan of his just in the way that it's very easy to be a casual fan of the Mountain Goats now. But anyone who picked up on him at that point in his life, because he didn't even have a career at that point, he was working in a hospital. And you know, just like this was the 90s when, and a lot of, he was doing this just because it was just the way he got his creative juices flowing. But a lot of those songs like the best ever death metal band out of Denton, Jenny, Color in Your Cheeks, those are some of the songs that are his most beloved to this day. And a lot of, you know, even though he is a very, first of all, if NPR, the National Public Radio, like aesthetic could be a person, it would be John Darnielle. Like he has that. And I don't know how well educated he is. He comes from a very blue collar place, a very working class position. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the authenticity attached. Mm-hmm. You don't get much more authentic than one musician. a boombox where you hit record on a tape, and you can still hear that hiss. You can still hear maybe like the errant noises of, mm-hmm. of maybe people walking, like closing doors behind him and things like that. But of course, now you know he's a very famous, very well known singer songwriter. Which again, I could give you like three friends of mine who could speak about John Darnielle uninterrupted for 2 hours. Because of that level of fandom that he has elicited through his songwriting, through his activism. But the fact that he chose the name The Mountain Goats, similar to, you know, rather than now Jeff Rosenstock he's released three solo albums now, and they're all fantastic, but they didn't necessarily want to release it as a solo record. Same thing, mm-hmm. actually, that's another thing that all of these artists have in common, is that rather than releasing it under their name, you know, like Jeff Rosenstock released those albums as quote unquote bomb the music industry because it was a project that was bigger than just him. Mm-hmm. Same thing with Greg Dooley with the Twilight Singers and Mike Skinner with the Streets, which of course, yeah, I didn't even mention that, like the name The Streets also is shorthand for authenticity. It's like, you know, basically, you know, these are sounds and rhymes that are coming from the streets. Whereas like if he put it out as Mike Skinner, then
there almost seems to be a second layer in all these things you're saying that is more as a, not so much the work in itself sometimes, but also the representation. Or this kind of like screen that, you know, goes with it.
Now the Mountain Goats includes John Worster on drums, the drummer from Superchunk, who's also a great comedian. And he I think it was, the songs were written with the idea that maybe one day they would be performed by a band called the Mountain Goats, but it was just John Darnielle for much of the history of the band. It was just him, mm-hmm. but not even like a name that's an abstract concept. Like bomb the music industry, it was a plural thing. He called himself the Mountain Goats, and I think that there's a very admirable lack of there's a very admirable amount of, I'd call it either humility or self-awareness, just mm-hmm. knowing that what you're doing, and I think that's a lesson that many of us can take away currently in our current situation, is that what you're doing or what you're putting out there is bigger than just you. I mean, any book that you put out there, and there was a time when I would disagree with this. Like when I was younger, I remember disagreeing with this, the idea that someone's interpretation is very important. And when I was younger, when someone would say that, I'd be like, that's not true. Like what the author meant is what the author meant. And now I realize, no, once mm-hmm. you put something out in popular culture, that's literally what popular culture means. It means it belongs.
Well, there has been I don't know if you heard about this or have noticed that there has been an increase in the material that came out since the coronavirus. People are actually putting so many, it's a pool, like on Bandcamp, for example. I have Bandcamp and it's release, release, release. It seems like there's no filter really in that sense, what you're saying.
Well, this actually reminds me of a sixth artist that I can squeeze in, who passed away about a decade ago now, Jay Riotard from Memphis. He was similarly burnt out on being in bands. He also had serious issues with anxiety and anger. But when he became a solo artist, he would just record, and even from back when he was a teenager, he would just record these really chaotic, loud punk songs at almost the moment of inspiration. And you can hear that like pouring out of his early demo recordings. There's definitely that, what you were just talking about. You want people to hear, and Jay talked about this in interviews. There was a documentary that came out about him a few years ago called, Better Than Something, or Waiting for Something. I think it's called Better Than Something. Mm-hmm. And he said in interviews where they asked, like, you know, you put out a lot of music, Jay. And he says, yeah, no, I don't want people, like, I feel like it's dishonest, like, you know, polishing and like reworking and, you know, basically slaving over something to make it absolutely perfect, because mm-hmm. that's not what people get when they come to a show. It's like, I want people to hear, to see the cuts. I want people to see the cuts and the pimples and things like that.
Well, I think that's very well captured. And, you know, I still am a fan of Beat Happening and, you know, Dicer Jr. And they do have that puerile, playful aspect to it that is super direct. And you can track it back to blues. You can track it back to Elvis. You can track all these recordings that are wonderful because of those properties that you can listen, hear. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Tyler. We're running out of time. It was a pleasure to speak to you. We can continue this conversation. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I really appreciate it.